Bridget and Cody. Comedians discussing obscure books with witty commentary. Odd books, bizarre books, awful books, oddball books, slightly racist, super racist. Get your fix from Cody and Runjit.
Welcome to Tomefoolery.
Tomefoolery.
How are you, Runjit?
Great. How are you today, Cody?
Yeah, you know, living, loving, learning. Trying my best.
Good.
Yeah.
That's three good things to do.
I'm just trying to be, be the best me I can be, right?
They all happen
all
to
I
start with
here.
An L sound, which is very convenient.
I like to keep it going, you know, laughing. I don't know. leeching, leprosy. I don't know. I've run out of things.
Oh, I was going to say learning, but that was actually one of the original.
That was one of the original.
Three,
there you go. Hey, you know
I
what?
I thought I was coming up with a great new addition to the list.
We're all trying, and that's what matters. How are you? Doing all right?
Doing great today. Very excited about today's book.
You excited? Yep. I'm excited about everything that's happening today.
Yeah, me too.
It's a nice foggy day. It's good times. So tell us about the book a little bit, Runjit.
Well, this book is called The Most Beautiful Woman in Town and Other Stories, and it's by one of my top five favorite writers in the world, Charles Bukowski.
Ooh.
I describe him to people who've never heard of him as probably the most famous writer that you've never heard of.
Nice.
He's just not super well known, but he has a huge cult following.
Right. And for those of you doing your Runjit leaderboard at home, he is top five. We don't know where in the five he is, but I'm sure over the period of the show, he's listed a couple of the other ones.
Yeah, my five don't have an order.
That's fine.
With top 10 lists, I think it's better to just have a list and not try to order them. So.
Right. So your top 10 list is more of a top 10 jamboree. I would say, yeah.
Okay, I don't know what that really
it's just
means.
Like a grouping. It's like a mosh.
Other than that, reminds me of being in Boy Scouts.
Fair enough. All right. and we're reading it's a collection of short stories is what we're reading.
Yeah,
today.
And we chose three or four. We, along with our guests for today, chose three or four stories from it that we're going to discuss. And he is an amazing writer of fiction, both short stories and novels, and poetry. I'm not even a big fan of poetry, but his poetry is amazing.
Well, yeah, so go check him out.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Runjit, do you want to introduce our esteemed guest for today?
I do. One of our guests today is Bruce Jarko. Hey there, Bruce.
Hello, Runjit. How are you? Cody?
Hi, doing all right. Thanks for having us.
We are doing great. It's nice to see you again.
Did I have you? Yes,
yeah.
Sure.
All right. And our second guest?
And our second guest is Mr. Mark Belden.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Honorific of Mr. Usually don't get that.
I wanted to make it clear he's male.
You studied for many years at university, I'm sure, for that degree.
It's a sign of age, Mark.
Apparently, yeah.
No, we're all misters here. Yeah.
Now, we invited these two together because they are longtime friends from their work at the Second City. And I actually know Bruce and so invited him, and he wanted to invite Mark, whom I did not know until recently. Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely clear on, like, you guys' history with the Second City and kind of where you were, when you were with that, or were you together apart, that kind of
thing.
Well,
I believe I preceded Mark on the main stage by about 5 to 10 years, something like that. Maybe shorter.
Yeah, maybe. You were appearing in a cast that I saw when I was in college, I think, and came up to visit Chicago.
So do the math on the age difference there, although usually there's no age requirement at Second City, but as it turns out, yeah. I think you have to be over 21 to be on the main stage because, you know.
Because of all the alcohol being
said. It is a bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there main stage work from about 79 to 82, 78 to 81, something like that. It's all a fog.
And then Mark, I guess that it would be safe to say that was part of your inspiration for going into that type of work, or
yeah, absolutely. I was in college and doing drama and appearing in plays and flailing around and making up my own lines much of the time. And then during the summer, I think of my last year there, a girl. Right after my last year of college, a girl from Evanston invited me to come on up and visit her. And I didn't turn that down. I was here as soon as I could get here. And her family was very nice, family in Evanston, and they arranged for us to go to hear some music out of Ravinia and a picnic and everything. And we sat and we ate. And then she casually just mentioned during this concert that there was a show after the concert in a little building that they is still there. I forget what it's called, but there's a little theater up there. And I said, I don't know what it is, but sure, let's go see it. And then it just turned out to be the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And I think you might have been in it. I'm not sure.
I'm trying to remember if I was. I know my wife Nancy was in it.
Yeah, and I think George was in it, and Aaron.
Yeah.
Aaron Freeman. Yeah. George Wendt. Are these the people you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think Tim.
Could have been. That could have been the, not to go back into some, you know, ugly history, but that could have been the Chateau Louise Touring Company that was then appearing at Ravinia on a couple of off nights. And there, at the time, there were, I believe, three companies, two touring and one main stage at Second City. One of the touring companies was had a permanent gig at the Chateau Louise Resort Hotel in Dundee, Illinois, and the other one was just a touring company that went around to colleges and primarily in the Midwest. And this, I think, was a the stepping stone. Went you took Del's workshop, you went into the first touring company, and then you got into the second touring company, and then you went to the main stage, and you just kind of waited for someone to retire or or go AWOL.
Get something better,
That's Del Close, by the way. I'm just providing footnotes.
No, that's good. Yeah, we need people at home. They're all writing notes now.
And was that Tim O'Malley you were talking about?
Tim Kazurinsky.
Oh, Tim Kazurinsky. Former guest.
Friend of the show.
On our show, yes.
Tim, that company out in Chateau Louise had Tim, George, my wife Nancy, McCabe Kelly. Who else was in that? John Smet. Any of you John Smet fans out there? and his wife, Jan Bina, or as we called them, Jonathan and Jonathan. And a few other. Aaron Freeman, Lee Ryan, people like that, some of whom made it into the resident company, others who didn't.
I performed at the Chateau Louise.
There you go.
I did eventually get to be in that company.
There you go.
That's a pretty awesome story. That's really kind of awesome.
Will the circle be unbroken?
The story my wife, who I met in the touring company, tells is that they went out on the stage and started doing the opening scene and realized about halfway through that there was nobody in the audience.
Yeah, that was that might be a separate story other than the one when my wife Nancy came and I was there, came backstage after the we've completed our first act to a lovely couple sitting in row number three. And she then went out at intermission and said, look, if you guys wouldn't mind, we'd buy you dinner if we didn't have to do the second act of the show. And they said, no, we want to see the second act of the show. So she literally begged them to leave. And
did they have to do the second act?
And we performed the second act,
Sure. Another funny story. Was it well received?
Hard to tell.
Yeah.
You know. We had a great time, though. Another story was we had a long delay before we were able to start one of our shows, and we were told that it was a busload of audience members that had been delayed on the tollway or whatever it was that went out that way. And so it was about a half-hour delay, and we finally put on the show, and we got no response from the audience, and we went backstage at intermission, and, you know, fuck these people. You know, this is like, you know, what the hell? They're not laughing. That's, you know, fuck them. Fuck them. And we get the lights come back up, and the first scene of the second act was a scene called PTA, in which we were mingling among the audience as PT members of a PTA meeting, and we got to see the people that, you know, had arrived late and caused this thing and didn't laugh. And we looked, and they were all mentally retarded kids from a some institution, and we all felt horrible. But we then ratcheted up our performance to be on, you know, just get as goony as we possibly could. And they laughed so hard in the second act that we could hardly complete the scenes because we were just, we played to their sensibilities, their, you know, whatever it was, and just gooned it
tailored
up.
Tailored the show.
Tailored the show to their needs, and they laughed hysterically, standing ovations. They couldn't get enough of us, so bless them.
That is awesome.
So yeah, so that was my the first cast that I actually started watching was George, Bruce, and Tim, Nancy, and Danny and Noni. Yeah, and
Mary
and Mary. Yeah, and
Mary
so,
Gross.
Mary Gross. Yeah, and so that was, you know.
I, by the way, I have heard this like urban legend around the Second City that Mary Gross cried a lot backstage. Is that a true story, or is that made up?
Why is it a legend? It's she cries in front of people. It shouldn't be a legend.
Okay,
at all.
Okay, it's true
she
then.
Weeps uncontrollably.
Most rehearsals were taken up by
walking down the street. She'll weep.
Okay.
It shouldn't be.
Well,
a
now we know for
all.
Sure.
I feel like she and I would get along really well. Spent a lot of time crying in the street. All right, so let's do this one by one. We're gonna introduce ourselves and the listeners to you guys as readers. So Mark, what did you read growing up?
The Hardy Boys.
Okay.
Every
the running theme of like Hardy Boys, Encyclopedia Brown, Nancy Drew, and the show, which I guess, I mean, just makes sense. But yeah,
it's funny, you know. I some friends of ours bought the set of Hardy Boy books for their kids, and they were like, "Well, we're really excited. We hope they're gonna read them and like them." And I said, "Well, let me take a look at those." And I looked at it, and it reminded me of like. It seemed like it was the first grade level writing. It was amazingly simple sentences and construction, and I can't believe I was captivated by it as a 21-year-old. So
yeah, well, all right.
That's when I started reading, when I was 21.
When you're 21?
Yeah.
So when you were a child at the age of 21, just reading Hardy Boys.
Yeah. No, it's just amazing. Thirsting that, you know, for adventure. Yeah. But they were great, and I was, you know, I was completely immersed in them. So I guess, you know, I guess that's a common thing.
Yeah.
Did you guys read those?
Oh, yeah.
I was an Encyclopedia Brown kid.
I was a Hardy Boys kid. And yeah. In fact, when I was 12, my family went on a trip to India, and one of the few things you could get at newsstands was Hardy Boys books.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's
so
fascinating.
I read a bunch of Hardy Boys books, like, on trains in India.
Wow. Oh,
anyway.
Wow. Okay.
And were there other people reading those too? Because that's
not
what
in
was
my family.
Or, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Not in my family.
I would not have expected that at all.
Yeah, it was weird.
Weird. All right. Bruce, what did you read growing up?
Well, I was just thinking about it, and really, I got a very slow start because I had a friend who was my best friend, who's still my best friend, was a voracious reader, and my parents used to always say, "Why don't you go over to Chris's house and read?" And strike one for reading. Strike two was the Hardy Boys, which is what everyone was reading, and I picked them one up, and I thought, this is really stupid. So.
The funny part is, you know, that's what Mark thought too, but then your courses diverged from there.
So, really, for the first, I'd say, until I got into high school, when you're force-fed books in high school to read, and fortunately I was force-fed some wonderful books and plays, and I spent the early part of my reading, you know, going through the mandatory, you know, Catcher in the Rye, and kind of graduating into you know, Confederacy of Dunces, and reading some Richard Farina, and I kind of discovered a few things I thought on my own, maybe I didn't, but I really enjoyed J.P. Donlevy books, you know, like The Ginger Man and Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B. And then
unexpurgated code.
He was. He's wonderful, and apparently a real curmudgeon. And then I discovered. I thought, Kurt Vonnegut and Thomas Berger. And I really enjoyed those because they were funny. And I really started to enjoy funny stuff. And it's kind of how Bukowski came to me, too, at a fairly early age. Jerzy Kaczynski. I meant to mention Jerzy Kaczynski, too, who actually the same friend of mine who was very the voracious reader had Jerzy Kaczynski as a professor at Wesleyan.
Wow.
And He said, I got this fantastic. He lasted 2 years at Wesleyan, and I was up at Amherst at the time. I lasted three, and I don't know why I put that in. Because it's true. It's
better than two. That's
better than two. Yeah. I outlasted him. You know, Mr. Voracious Reader, can only hang in there 2 years at Wesleyan.
He burned himself out young.
Well, but he kept talking about Jerzy Kaczynski, and so finally I picked up a copy of The Painted Bird, and I read that, and it was fantastic. And then, being there, and it was fantastic. Mm. And then stories started coming out about how he was a plagiarist, and he was being sued, and he was marrying, and he was, involved in all these sex clubs in New York City and everything, and his reputation just got completely tainted. But at least I'm one handshake away from Jerzy Kaczynski if he's still alive.
And he killed himself.
Yeah, he did. Okay. There you go. I lost track of Jerzy.
Yeah. I find it interesting.
He's dead.
Well, I only, as a footnote to that, I remember talking to Michael McCarthy, another Second City alumnus, who was telling me, and a great writer, who was going on and on about how he had found out that Jerzy Kaczynski, apparently his working method was get up, work for a while, take a long nap, and then get it back up and work in the midnight oil, burning the midnight oil. And then not long after that, the guy shot himself in the head. And I said, well, maybe it's not the best working method. Yeah. Did you like to read Woodhouse at all?
No, I got close. I read a lot of Kingsley Amis, which I think is close to P.G. Woodhouse.
Yeah. I love Woodhouse.
And
he's one of my favorite authors.
Yeah. Actually, this same well-read friend of mine is into Martin Amis. And I can't stand Martin Amis. I find him kind of pretentious, and he talks down kind of the way Dan Brown writes. I can't stand Dan Brown either because he talks down to the audience. But I loved his father, not Dan Brown's, but Amis. Martin Amis was, or Kingsley Amis was, Lucky Jim and all that. It was really very, very funny. So, I didn't find Martin very funny.
So, Bruce, what do you read now? I think we've kind of touched a little bit on that, or at least we started moving towards present day.
I tend to kind of go through authors. I've read all of John le Carré's novels. I find him just an exquisite writer. Martin Cruz Smith is the same. He's another exquisite writer. There's this other guy who writes about pre-World War II mystery novels. I can't remember his name right now. I never remember his name. I'll think of it later. But I just finished Le Carré's latest one, The Delicate Truth, which was very good. Okay. I find them all very good. And right now I'm reading this period mystery novel called The Alienist.
I heard about that. Yeah.
It's Caleb. Carr.
Caleb Carr. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
He lasted Alienist. 2 years at my college.
Really? Yeah. Really? Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Because it's kind of an interesting book. It's at times really kind of simple and stupid, but then it gets into some interesting kind of historical nuances of Teddy Roosevelt's New York City.
Yeah.
Which is great.
When he was the
commissioner of police.
Yeah.
The reformer.
And the further you get into that, I think the better it gets.
Yeah, and it's a psychological thriller, and you have to imagine a world without, pretty much without telephones and cars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they did have telephones, but there's no cars. And it's weird because everyone's driving around in a carriage, and then they say, I had to stop because of the elevated train going overhead. And you're going, well, they had L's. Where is this society? You know, if you got a train, figure it out. Get a car. 1896. Come on.
So you like historically placed?
Yeah, I'm in love with the historical fiction.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Mark, what do you read these days?
Well, you know, I like a lot of that stuff that Bruce was talking about, oddly enough, and Martin Cruz Smith and Daniel Silva. Anything that, you know, occasionally I just have to read something that took place during World War II or the Cold War. I like Len Dayton almost as much as I like. Le Carré, because just like his characters and the way he writes, and you know, and I go back and forth between fiction and nonfiction.
Okay, what do you read on nonfiction?
I just finished David and Goliath, which is fascinating.
Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes, yeah, and you know, it just comes right out of the box, just incredible, with so many turning so many things on their heads. And then, I finished Huck Finn again.
Oh, wow. Okay.
About a month ago. I don't know why. I just said, you know, I can't remember the last time I read it. And
do you talk to Michael Gelman a lot? Cause he's a very strong proponent of that book.
Is that right?
A couple of our last episode with him, he spent a while talking about it. I think he hands out copies to people sometimes, is what he said on that episode.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's a huge fan of that book.
Well, we did a scene in ETC called Huck Finn that had almost nothing to do with the book, except that it was set in a class, and that was, I think, the suggestion that came from the audience, and it was set in a classroom where the teacher was Harry Murphy, was trying to teach Huck Finn, and then it was just a ridiculous scene. But that, and I love me some good historical fiction. I just read, somebody gave me a copy of this book called Agincourt by Bernard Cornwell, who apparently has written about a zillion historical fiction books. I hadn't heard of him, but I enjoyed that. Apparently pretty close to accuracy. Mm-hmm. And then I enjoy these books by Candace Millard. Has anybody heard of her?
No.
She wrote this book about Teddy Roosevelt and his trip down it was called The River of Doubt. And he just went.
Oh, yeah.
He caught malaria. Yeah. His son.
His son died.
I remember hearing about that book.
I read that.
Yeah, and then she just came out with
He almost died.
Yeah, he almost died. And then, you know, back then, I don't know, maybe still, if you get malaria, it just stays in you, and you just kind of get a little better.
You get malaria in the Amazon.
You're pretty
screwed. Right, yeah. Especially back then.
Teddy Roosevelt almost died way too many times for a person who still continued living. Like, there was a lot of chances.
Find it very helpful to kind of cleanse the palate. With reading every so often, is that I'll go through a bunch of historical crime novels and, you know, whatever kind of historical novels, historical fiction, and then just have to get me some nonfiction.
Yes.
Just to kind of cleanse things. There's a book that a friend of mine wrote called This Indian Country, which is a fascinating exploration of American Indian political activism from the Revolutionary War to the present. And it's a great book, but then you get about two-thirds of the way through that, and it gets kind of, you know, sorry, Fred, but it gets a little dry, and then I got to go back to John Le Carré or somebody like that. But I find it, to switch it up every once in a while, I need to, and that, you know, breeds diversity. You know, it's interesting, though, that all of us here are pretty much engaged in the theater, and none of my casual reading is plays.
Oh, yeah.
I don't do any.
No,
you know,
me neither.
I can't stand to pick up a play as a casual thing unless somebody
hard to read.
Yeah, they're, you know, unless somebody hands it to me and says, you've got to read this play or whatever.
Oh, then I won't.
Well, I'm not going to learn any of the lines, that's for sure. Don't make me do that, because usually when that's thrust into your script, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
How many words do I have to say? I don't want to do that. Too many words.
Let's get into Bukowski. I felt like that was a decent enough segue in. To clarify to the listeners at home, we're not doing the entire collection. Runjit, do you want to tell us what exactly?
We collectively chose four stories from The Most Beautiful Woman in Town and Other Stories. They are the title story, The Most Beautiful Woman in Town.
The titular.
That's right. 6 Inches is the next one. Mm-hmm. The Gut-Ringing Machine and The Beginner. So, listener, if you would like to read those before you listen, you can, but you don't
please
have
pause
to.
Please pause the podcast now.
Yeah, you don't have to.
I got please a different press, list. I'm yeah. sorry.
Yeah.
Did I get the
Are
wrong
you serious?
List? No, I'm not serious.
Oh. I was like,
professional
shoot.
Comedians.
We just like the air to go out of the balloon.
I am one thing you need to know, I'm totally gullible.
So am I. We're both extremely gullible.
Pretty much, yeah. Anything you say, we'll believe.
But I did like your attempt to create tension on the podcast. That's good. We need some riveting moments.
And then I ruined it by just going straight to the... Really? And then you had to admit that
like
it was
it.
A bit. Yeah.
No, usually, you know, I'm used to my own children who don't, you know, pay don't any listen. Attention to anything I say. It doesn't matter.
Oh, man. All right. So, how did you guys feel about, well, you're a Bukowski fan and have you read Bukowski?
I have read him in the distant past and again, now. So I'm not as much of a Bukowski person as Bruce. So I'll let him go first.
Well, I hadn't read Bukowski in a very long time, mm-hmm. and it all brings back memories of reading him for the first time. I started with his poetry,
mm-hmm.
and I tried to remember what I thought about, what drew me to him at an early age, and I think it was the titillation of reading someone who's writing about a subject in a manner that glorifies drinking and having sex and debauchery and just a general lifestyle.
Was this during college that you were reading Bukowski?
Yeah, pretty Bruce? Much in college yeah. and right after.
Yeah.
And I started out reading his poems, oddly enough. I think probably just because of the title of the book of poetry. You pick up a title that's like the first word in the title is ejaculations, and you go, huh. And you pick that off the shelf, and then you start reading. And then I got into his novels of, Factotum and Women and Post Office, of course, became kind of he kind of brings you into his world. And Mark and I were talking before we got here that his stories are very simple. You can tell right away that he's a fan of Hemingway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's got certain themes that are very easily identifiable. His villains are obvious bad guys. The targets of his derision are pretty obvious. His solutions to those dealing with those targets are very simple. And you start going, well, is there something deep that I'm missing here? You know, because of all of this simplicity going on. And I was telling Mark, I think of him on these short stories as kind of like Aesop. He's a fable teller. He tells these kind of the same story. They all revolve around a guy who drinks a lot and has the ugly guy who gets the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in the first story here, that's exactly what it is. He meets the most beautiful girl in town in a bar. And she is immediately attracted to him, and he tells her that, yes, she's beautiful, but he likes her for his mind, and they go back to his place, of course, and develop a relationship. And she is not very comfortable being a beautiful woman and thinks that people take advantage of her for her beauty, and mm-hmm. he's telling her that that's quite all right, and everyone's a jerk but me, and... and she goes, I love you, Hank, and then he goes away for 2 weeks, and she... kills herself, and that's the end of the story. So you're thinking, well, that's a fairly simple story. And I remember reading these stories going, isn't that great? But what does it mean? Is there something that I'm missing with all of these? And I, to this day, you go, well, perhaps it just means what it says, and that simplicity is what is charming about it.
Mm. Yeah, see, that's why I enjoy his poetry, even though I'm not a poetry enjoying person, really, because that was a weird phrase.
Yeah,
poetry enjoying person.
Enthusiast.
Are you a member of the club? But
pep club.
But yeah, his poetry is very plain. It's very just like, you don't have to like try to analyze what is he getting at, as you do with a lot of poetry. It's like, it's very clear what he's getting at. Mm. And I think his story, they're very straightforward, you know? That's what
but
I like
I think
about
they
him.
Are, they're parables. They're Aesop stories. They're moralistic in a way. If you really want to read into some, there's a moral to this story, and there's a message, whether or not it's deeper than what I can conceive or not. But you want there to be a message.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a psychological lens into his mind because he. From what I know about him and what I'm perceiving of him from this collection, I don't think he did a lot of rewriting. I think that, and I know that he just worked on a typewriter, and he drank a lot, and all the other things that he had going on in his life. So I'm thinking that this, the sheer amount of writing he did and the sheer negligible amount of rewriting that I guess that he did, it's almost like an automatic writing. It's almost like a, from time to time, you just get a lens right into his psyche.
Yeah, I agree. And most of it, most of his writing, nearly 90% of it, I would say, is exactly like that. It's as if he recognized that, you know, through his career in writing, that these themes were popular. And he just kept at it.
Mm.
He never really left the neighborhood that he describes in his early novels. It's the same kind of, I mean, the picture in my mind anyway, is he lived in the same kind of hovel and went to the same series of bars and met the same type of women and dealt with the same type of people.
Yeah.
The racetrack being the only other location that I can think of that is a recurring, you know, that is different from his normal, you know, haunts. Mm-hmm. And it's as if he figured, well, if they're buying this stuff, I'll just keep writing it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's also that simplicity that you're talking about and just kind of the thing of like the write what you know kind of a thing. That's what he does. That's who he is. And there's a simplicity to it, kind of that, that just, you know, that beat poet kind of simplicity.
He had that. Yeah, I was telling Mark also. I had the occasion to see him recite poetry. I was at a small venue in Evanston, you know, 30 years ago, and mm-hmm. he was reciting poetry at this place. And he, of course, was then a rock star with everybody in the audience. And he brought in, as I told Mark, a huge can, like a 12-ounce can of like malt liquor or something like that. And before he even started, he just drank the whole thing down, and we watched him drink. And then before he started, he asked the audience if anyone had anything to drink. And I remember coming into the venue and having the security say, "Now, please, no alcohol is, you know, so I said, well, good luck with that. Well, somebody pulled out a fifth of peppermint schnapps and went down to Bukowski, and he took a long pull of that and then recited his poems. And it was kind of magical to watch him do that, but at the same time, I was thinking to myself, if he were describing this event, he'd probably be describing it as a chore, that mm-hmm. this is, you know, God, I got to read for these people and read this stuff that I wrote. And he was, you know, not a very good reader of his own works, and he just seemed like otherwise engaged, like he couldn't wait to get out of there. And we're all rapt and you know, going, ooh,
right.
He's just as ugly as his picture on the back flap of the book. His voice is a little higher than I would have imagined, but and he's short, you know, that sort of thing. So that was it. He kind of is what he is, and
right.
He made a career more than anyone I can remember out of being himself.
Yeah,
that is an awesome story. Can we read something that I gave you guys earlier that none of you guys have seen yet? So this first quote, your story just totally reminded me of these some of the things in this, Bruce. So this first quote is from his wife, Linda Lee Bukowski. Hank despised Mickey Mouse, especially his hands. I think he has three fingers. He could not handle the fact that the power over multi-millions of human beings was in the hands of this foolish creature that taught you nothing whatsoever, that expressed nothing real, total absurd fucking fantasy, not even good, not even creative. He was appalled by Mickey Mouse.
Sounds about right. This is Charles Bukowski during one of his poetry readings in response to a heckler. Now if I start reading this poem and I hear this man's voice rising above the sound of my own, I'm going to go over to him and kick his living ass right here out of here, physically. I'm going to kick his ass right out of this goddamn hall. So watch it, man. I'll take you like a motherfucker. That's a good way to handle a heckler.
Yeah, I will kind of want to memorize this speech.
Yeah, like just Danny Breen.
Give it. Just give it anytime there's a heckler. Okay, so Mark, this next quote is long, but it's a kind of a great little story.
All right. So. This is Taylor Hackford, the film director. Lawrence Ferlinghetti up in San Francisco invited Bukowski to go to San Francisco to read at the City Lights Poets Theater and invited me to film it. I'd never heard him read, but I decided to do it. We go up in the plane, he's drinking scotch. He got pretty silly, and I was shooting the whole thing. We arrive in San Francisco at the theater, and my God, it was like the second coming. We walked into this big gymnasium, and there were bleachers set up, and there were like 600-700 people there. He was a little drunk and a little scared, and it was a loud, rowdy audience. At the same time, he didn't have to share the podium. This was a Bukowski event. Later, he wrote an article about going to San Francisco to read and having this punk, asshole, stupid filmmaker along. And he was trying to help the filmmaker along, and he was organizing this and that, and the filmmaker was bumbling through and asking stupid questions. It was an entertaining and funny piece. So I read it, and I saw him later, and I said, "Hank, I read that article." And he says, "Yeah, baby, what'd you think?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was full of shit, man. I have the film. You're the guy who was drunk on the plane, making a fool out of himself, out of yourself, and you made me." He says, "Hey, baby, when I write, I'm the hero."
And then the final quote here is for you to read, Bruce.
Okay, this is from an unnamed friend. Bukowski hated those pastoral beginnings of novels. It was a beautiful land, rugged. There were snow-capped mountains in the distance. And Tom Haney came along in his old jalopy. "Oh my God," Bukowski would say, "why? Why do they start with crap like that? That isn't real." And so how does Post Office begin? First line is, "It began as a mistake." I mean, what a great opening. The reader thinks, well, what began as a mistake?
And because of that quote about how, you know, Bukowski loved first, he liked to make the first line good. What I did is I compiled here a list of the first lines of every story from this collection. There are 30 stories. We don't have to do all of them. This is in the same document. We don't have to read all of them, so we can kind of pick and choose. But we're going to do a little, like, kind of pseudo poetry slam with just first lines of stories from this book. All right? So, gentlemen, we can pick and choose. You don't have to do all of them.
All right.
I'm going to provide a little bass music.
Okay, we're doing it that way.
Other people can do that, too, if you want to, because I might want to read a line here or there, too. So, you guys ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Ready?
All right. Sure. Here we go. Boom, boom. Boom, boom.
Mark, you want to go first? Boom,
it was a hot night boom, in Tony's. Boom, you didn't even boom, think of boom, fucking.
Boom, boom, boom. You know how it is with horse players.
Cass was the youngest and most beautiful of five sisters.
The first 3 months of my marriage to Sarah were acceptable, but I'd say a little after that our troubles began.
We lived right across from MacArthur Park, Linda and I, and one night while drinking, we saw a man's body fall past our window.
Old Sanchez is a genius, but I am the only one who knows it, and it's always good to go see him.
The bell rings, and I open the side window by the door. It is night. Who is it? I ask.
The President of the United States of America entered his car, surrounded by his agents.
Mickey was all right, but we had our troubles.
Harry and Duke. The bottle sat between in a cheap hotel in downtown L.A.
The ambulance was full, but they found me a place on top, and away we went.
So, the Hollywood Park meet has begun, and naturally, I've been out a couple of times, and the scene is not very variable. The horses look... the same... The people a little worse. The horse player is a combination of extreme conceit, madness, and greed.
All right, last round.
Well, I got off the deathbed and came out of the county hospital and got a job as a shipping clerk.
Mason had her on the phone.
And Herb would drill a hole in a watermelon and fuck the watermelon and then force Talbot, little Talbot, to eat it up.
The Bukowski first line poetry slam.
Well, I think we all learned a lot.
You could learn a lot by the last line, too.
That is interesting.
The last line of 6 inches, I thought, was just wonderful.
Oh.
The beginner, too.
Yeah. The door said 98, 99, 100, 101. I was walking north toward the Hollywood Hills, toward those mountains behind them, with the great and golden light of the Lord shining upon me. Growing.
Nice.
That's great.
It's just, yeah. You could almost do a first line, last line on these stories. And if you've read enough of him, fill in pretty much accurately in between. But he's, I think later on, we were talking, Mark and I, earlier, that later on he got to be a little bit, he concentrated a little harder, I think, and was a better wordsmith, I thought. He started adding some imagery to his descriptions, and I think he felt the importance of some of his themes that he could augment with alliterations and similes and things like that that were very creative, and you just, it was a pleasure to read a lot of those as a different.
That's totally true. Yeah, totally true. And he actually started writing poetry much later in his career, and that's when I think that improved his prose writing, because more image based, and like you have to really think about every word. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You really have to craft it, and that's evident. Like some of his writing, prose writing, becomes very poetic.
Right.
You know? Did you have the last line of the beginner? Ready to read, Mark?
The last line of the beginner is, uh-oh.
Simplicity.
I think I'm right on that, aren't I?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. You have it there, you can verify.
Yeah, well, I don't have to. I trust you.
All right.
Judges, does it count?
Yeah.
The last line of the gut-wrenching machine is, and he doesn't capitalize. There were sentences he just doesn't capitalize. He threw out the dollar cigar, lit another, ran the caddy up to 90, straight at the sun like an arrow. Business was good and life, and the tires swirled over the dead and the dying to be. Zayum. It's really.
I like that image though. The tires swirling and just heading up toward the sun,
driving over
the dead and the dying to be. Oh,
well,
that's
one
great
thing that he makes perfectly clear, that as I kind of rung with my sensibilities, is that he glorified art, and that the people that didn't have art or refused to accept their own art were dead inside and were gutless and were afraid of expressing their feelings. This is kind of one of his themes that's easily recognizable, but it was, you know, it was heartening to hear when you first pick up a book that, because you're kind of afraid that your own sensibilities and your own reason for liking it are going to be called into question at some point. But his attention to that it's okay, that it's, you know, he makes it okay to be an artist. And to at least have sensibilities, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote a poem about that called "The Genius of the Crowd" that I printed out, just one copy. So can you guys read it together? Like,
there is enough treachery, hatred, violence, absurdity in the average human being to supply any given army on any given day. And the best at murder are those who preach against it. And the best at hate are those who preach love. And the best at war, finally, are those who preach peace. Beware, the average man, the average woman, beware their love. Their love is average, seeks average. But there is genius in their hatred. There is enough genius in their hatred to kill you, to kill anybody. Not wanting solitude, not understanding solitude, they attempt to destroy anything that differs from their own.
Keep going. You're on a roll.
Okay. Not being able to create art, they will not understand art. They will consider their failure as creators only as a failure of the world. Not being able to love fully, they will believe your love incomplete, and then they will hate you. And their hatred will be perfect, like a shining diamond. Like a knife, like a mountain, like a tiger, like hemlock, their finest art.
He seemed like a guy that didn't explain himself usually, but in a way, he did.
He was trying, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
I think he was trying to explain himself, and I think, he just, I think he got better. I really do think he got better at it as time went on.
To go back to that gut ringing machine, was he? Do you feel like that he was
one of the guys?
Can I briefly describe this for the reader? Just
yes, please.
Or for the listener, yeah. So the gut ringing machine is this story. It has these two guys who run this like temp agency, but it's a weird temp agency, kind of surreal. Where what they do is they have a bunch of men, like, stored up, live men, and then when they're going to send a temp out, they take one of the men, put them through this ringer, this actual machine that wrings all the blood and guts and spirits out of the man, and then they send him off to do temp work. That's a decent synopsis, right?
Yeah.
Did I miss anything there? Yeah.
No, the only thing I found hard to understand in that was, and it was... I found another thing hard to understand when he starts explaining money. they pay you $500 or $300 for a week for the first 2 weeks, but we get that check, and if you fire them, we give you a refund of $500. And I couldn't wrap my head around that whole concept, but there was something crooked in the money there, just like he writes an awful lot about the track. There's a wonderful story that's contrapuntal to the beginner in here. It's about horse racing and it's the non-horseshit horse advice is what he writes, and he explains the percentages taken by the state and by the track and by the, you know, then there's this other nominal fee that they round up every dime or something like that and take 4 to 9 cents of your money. But what was your question again? I forgot.
It was your question, Mark.
Oh, was he one of the guys?
Yeah. Oh, well, was he talking about his own experiences? Was he considering himself a gutless person and by accusing others of I don't know.
I took it as an observation.
Agency.
I took it as an observation of the world around him that the. This is what we do to people, society is now geared to squeezing the guts out of you and putting you in positions of that perform certain tasks, and that this is the acceptable way to go, and that there must be some machine somewhere run by a couple of guys that squeeze the guts out of you and because he can't explain it otherwise. How do people lose their fortitude, their convictions?
That's what I thought at first, but then when I found out about, you know, I think you printed out actually his letter where he's kind of begging to get back in at the post office.
Yeah, can we read those actually?
Yeah,
Bruce,
sure,
can you?
Yeah.
The title of this page is Bukowski's two letters to the post office.
Oh yeah, to the postmaster, Los Angeles, California. Please accept my resignation as regular carrier effective 3/11/55. I find this occupation is detrimental to my health. I am bothered with ulcers, and the pressure and demands of the job are aggravating my condition. The post office has treated me well. It's only that I must seek a more congenial occupation, and I regret the severance. Henry C. Bukowski, Jr.
And then here's the second letter.
This is dated June 1955, 3 months after the first letter. Dear Sirs, I was a regular carrier at Oakwood Station with over 3 years' service. Last April, I resigned from the service. This letter is written in hope that I may be reinstated as a substitute carrier. I gave as my reason for resignation ill health. This, I will state bluntly, was an untruth. I realize now that I was in the wrong, and if I had only taken a little more time to cool and objective, I never would have handed in my resignation. I hope to prove to you that I can be a carrier worthy of my salt and do it well. I promise that should you decide in my favor, that you will never regret the decision. Sincerely, H. Bukowski, Jr. He was rehired 3 years later and worked there full-time for 12 more years.
Wow.
So you could be right.
Yeah, don't you see a connection between that and the gut ringing machine,
yeah,
perhaps?
You know,
it's like he went back with his, you know, tail between his legs. I mean, that second letter is so unlike it, you know? It's very un-Bukowski, that letter.
Yeah, I'm sure he probably hoped that nobody would ever see that.
Yeah. I promise that should you decide in my favor, you will never regret that. That's so on him.
Yeah.
And when you think about what it's probably like inside a post office, and probably a big one where he worked.
In L.A.,
It's probably a lot like a factory or a warehouse where that's depicted in that gut-wringing machine.
Yeah, well, they used to have contests. Did you guys hear and see about these contests they used to have at the post office where he worked, where with the cubby holes? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
They would have
a
contest where they would have a bunch of cubby holes, and you would have a bunch of envelopes with different addresses on them, and you would have to throw them from like several feet away and get them in the right cubby holes.
Oh my god!
And like the guys who did the worst at the contest would lose their job, and they did this like every 2 or 3 months to like, you know, trim out the bad employees. Can you imagine him?
Wow.
How humiliating that was for him.
Yeah. Probably just walking through the doors every day in the first place. Pretty bad for an artist of his standing.
That letter must have been so hard for him to write. Oh.
Yeah. And I just love that he blatantly stated it was an untruth. Just to put it bluntly, look, I lied. I'm sorry.
And it worked.
I know.
They hired him back.
Well, 3 years, I guess. They got desperate. Oh, man. And so nobody here had read any of these specific short stories before today, or before right? Or Bruce, had you read?
I had, no.
I was familiar with one of them, but because I think it appeared in...
one of his other collections.
It appeared in Erections, Ejaculations, Exhibitions, and General Tales of Ordinary Madness.
Oh, okay.
But I was thinking as you were talking about all of that, that one of the, he kind of struggles with not behaving like the average person who's had their guts, you know, removed from them. And he glorifies all of that. And one of the ways he does it is that he always describes his winning at the track. There was this one in one of the book stories. He wins a lot of money at the track, like $4,000. And he immediately goes and rents a motel room and hires hookers and just completely blows it on, you know, wine, women, and song in a motel room until he's out of his $4,000. Because that's, you know, instead of like, well, I'll put some in the bank and, you know, maybe, you know, buy some decent groceries or, you know.
Well,
you
I mean,
know,
that's the end of the
buys
beginner.
Buys a new car and gets a hotel room and blows it on hookers.
Well, the end of the beginner is, oh, man, if I make more money at this, I can get a better girlfriend that will yeah. probably cost more.
And the theme of the beginner is that these horses can be beat.
Yeah.
You know, he's convinced that, you know, doing
well,
it for the first
it's
time.
It's his
hey,
naive.
I can do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's that,
you
yeah.
know? And that's the, you know. It's the fool's paradise that he mm-hmm. described. Yeah.
And also the woman that kind of got him there, invited him there, yeah. showed him the ropes and everything. She's, you know,
yeah.
you're not good enough.
Yeah. yeah.
Once I win some money, screw yeah. you. Right. Thanks for introducing me to this.
Yeah,
awesome
I got
thing.
This knocked. And through the story, the thing that tickled me was like, through the story as she was demure at the beginning and then, you know, he started making these little comments to her like, you know, pull your skirt down.
Yeah.
You know, you look like a... He just started running her down as the day went on.
And he gave her an allowance.
Yeah.
You're out of your money. You can't bet anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Here's your $6. Yeah.
And he just kept betting like crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, that one made me laugh.
I liked that one, and I liked, I liked all of them. 6 inches made me uncomfortable, but I think it's supposed to. But also, as a homosexual, there were scenes in that where I was just like, oh, I did not want to ever read this.
Well, you don't have to be a homosexual to be
I know.
That's why uncomfortable
part of the
scenes.
Reason why I wanted to introduce that was because I feel like part of it was that you were supposed to be made uncomfortable and that, to kind of put yourself in that mindset. But I didn't know how uncomfortable everybody else would feel about that as much as I felt uncomfortable about that.
Yeah, of course, it's designed okay. because he's. I think deep down, I think he was terrified of women.
Yeah,
and he imagined them having powers over mm-hmm. him,
and they did have power over him.
Well, in this yeah, in yeah. that story, of yeah. course, he was. Right. You know, she was a witch, and she's not a witch. Yeah, she was a witch, or you yeah. know, whatever. But this is, you know, his relationship with women is. That's a whole day's worth of conversation.
Right.
I
well,
think.
And a lot of that is inherent in that story. Not even just because she's a witch, but she's a witch, and yet is still he stays with her the whole time. Is just extremely docile about the whole situation. He raises a couple of complaints about it from time to time, but then just kind of sticks around
as he knows she's destroying him.
Right, yeah. And it's never about him being worried that she's a witch and will do something, but it's more that it's just he's comfortable and she's very good at plying him.
Well, it starts out like a lot of stories that when he first meets a girl, she's the greatest fuck I ever had in my life, yeah. and so he stays.
Yeah.
You know, and you go, well, that's all he needs to say. You know, yeah. Okay.
One thing that's just making me think of, and as you know, your original comment that it was made you feel uncomfortable, but I think that the thing that made me think was anybody who had a mother would be uncomfortable reading this story. Because that's where we all came from in the first place.
Ah, fair enough.
And the more I think about it, the more it is. Not only does he succumb to it sort of willingly, but it is in a way a return to the womb. And I'm not just literally, but she begins to he depends on her. He becomes dependent on her for his beer,
yeah, mm-hmm.
and food, and she has
him do little tricks and stuff, yeah.
My biggest laugh in that whole story, though, was knowing that that was what's going to happen at the end, that he was going to be stuck up inside her at some point, because you're reading this, and as the shorter he gets, and you're going, I'm reading Bukowski's story about a shrinking man. Oh, he's not going to do that, is he?
And
his
it's called
6 inches.
Yeah, exactly.
It's titled
and,
6 inches.
You know, it comes to fruition, and you go, you know, I should have seen this coming from the title.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I didn't think about it until it was too late.
Well, when I read the title, I thought it was going to be about his penis. And, you know, I didn't. I had, and even by the, only just before she grabbed him and did that, did I.
But he
if
does,
you're listening at home.
He does fool you in some of the titles, like, like in 10 Jackoffs was a great schmuck bait. For a title, and you're thinking it's going to be about 10 guys who are really idiots, but it's the number of times this guy had to masturbate in order to take a picture of his ejaculation. He couldn't get the focus right because he's got one hand on his on his dick and one hand trying to get the focus of his camera right, and it took him 10 times.
And 12, anything with a number in it, he seems to be fooling.
And that was Sanchez, one of the brightest guys he knows, is from the quote. That was, you know, he
dick pics
Sanchez.
Are so much easier today, aren't they?
I know, right? It was, yeah.
Thank you, technology.
We've all been there. Yeah. Oh, man.
Well, they he also had one kind of a wonderful pun in the 6 inches, which was when he got fired in that story. He said it was small of him to let me go like that.
Oh, I know. I missed the pun.
I read that. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah.
And the other phrase that I really loved in that was when she let out an extra illuminated moan.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty nice.
To clarify for the listener at home who may not have read the story, she uses him once he's down to 6 inches in the act of onanism. I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, because we're talking about it. Out. They may not know.
I've never heard that word, but I read the story, so I know what it means now.
And the other interesting thing is, Mark and I were talking also that he kills her with a hat pin.
Yes,
and it's the second story that we read involving a hat pin.
Yes.
Involving a hat pin with going glass, through flesh.
Yeah. A glass beaded hat pin.
I wonder if there's a thing about that.
Well, it was, I think he looked at objects around him.
Yeah.
He obviously had a lot of esoteric, things in his apartment or, you know, where he went. And that was one of them. It struck him.
I guess women still used hat pins at that point in time.
Yeah.
One thing I especially love about his writing is there's a lot of humor in it. Though it's kind of dark and like the lowest kind of, places in life, but here's a particular paragraph that I really liked from the story 6 inches. Sarah began counting my calories. She took away my fried foods, bread and potatoes, salad dressing, but I kept my beer. I had to show her who was wearing the pants in our family.
I love that line. Yeah.
Oh, there's just great little lines like that throughout.
There was another story in which the woman put him on a regimen of pounding his sides.
Same story. Oh, yeah. That's right.
6 inches.
Okay.
She would ask him if he did it at the end of every day, and he would say yes, like 400 times on each side. He'd do it when he's walking down the street. The thing that I just noticed, and this might have been just blatantly apparent to everybody else, but especially in the four stories that we read, there's an arc of control and loss of control. The attempt to maintain control while also not having it. Like the racetrack, he thinks he has control over it, but doesn't have control over it. In the beginning, he doesn't have it at all. In The Most Beautiful Girl in Town, he's trying to control her, and she's trying to control her own body. And there's a lot of control conflict. 6 inches, there's the control where he thinks he's in control and she's actually in control. And then a gut-wrenching where there's the whole ripping, obviously, of control. And so it's just a lot of control.
That's very interesting.
I just noticed that.
And that was actually definitely true in his life with his relationships with women.
Yeah.
You know, like every relationship he had, his wives and or girlfriends, it's always described by friends and acquaintances that she had all the power. Like she would leave. I'm saying she to refer to several of them at different times. She would leave for like weeks at a time. He wouldn't know where she was, but he would stay home, and then he would just pine for her to come back, no matter who it was. That's how the relationship was.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was always an ephemeral quality to every situation or relationship that he had. And in fact, his longest relationship with anything or anybody was with alcohol. He never left alcohol, but he left women. He left friends, bars, places, whatever. They were all pretty short-lived,
mm-hmm.
except for alcohol.
I used to have the same relationship with Mountain Dew when I was younger. That's true. That's a true fact. That's a statement.
I would love, I found a little interview. By the way, some of these things I have to say, I took from a documentary that's on YouTube that was really well done. It's called Born Into This, which is the name of one of his famous poems. And Cody's laughing because I always recommend YouTube clips.
Yeah, this is his long running secret.
I'm trying to get YouTube to sponsor our show.
I think they're already sponsoring you and you're just secretly putting it into the show. I think they're paying you off.
But yeah, this is an amazing, really good documentary on YouTube. It's like 2 hours long.
Called Born Into This.
Yeah, so, and it's super well done. I mean, really good. So yeah, like some of those interviews and stuff that I pulled were from that. And this too, this is called Interview Transcript. Bruce and Mark, I'd like you guys to do a reading of this. Mark, can you play the interviewer? And Bruce, you can play Bukowski, just a little excerpt from an interview he did on TV.
While reading your book, Women, one could get the impression that for you, a woman is nothing more than a behind and a pair of tits.
Oh, come on. You read it. Is that all you got? You didn't even get to the parts where I cried in bed because tears came to my face because I invited two women to have Thanksgiving with me and I didn't know which one to go. No, no, no. I wasn't just jumping into bed and fucking and jumping out of bed. I'm sorry. It would be nice for me to say that, and I pretend I'm a tough guy, but I'm not that tough.
But in your stories, love is always a synonym for sexual intercourse.
Where do you get this crap, baby? Love is a dog from hell. That's all. It has its own agonies. It brings its own agonies. But I mean, I don't know where you get your concepts from, man. You're really fucked up.
And scene. Nice.
I also like that the interviewer said behind and then said tits. Like, I thought he was going to try to go clean, and then he just went with tits. He's like, right.
Behind and a pair of tits.
Yeah.
All right.
Love is a dog from hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, he's, he has a love-hate relationship with love.
Yeah.
You know?
Which I guess this turns into a hate-hate relationship.
Yeah.
I like that his situation that he comes up with, though, that brings tears to him to his eyes is the
two women at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
It doesn't really prove his point, actually. Oh. There's lots of footage on YouTube, Betty,
I know,
of him getting angry with different people, you know, while being filmed. So he had no problem expressing anger.
Well, he's German, you know.
He is.
He's got there's a built-in. I always kind of secretly liked that. There weren't too many German guys writing books that had this artistic and aesthetic sensibility.
Yeah.
You know, there was Hermann Hesse and then some of the poets, I guess. But, you know, geez, for a guy from Andernach, Germany to, you know.
Oh, he was born in Germany? I didn't realize. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And his dad was a very, like, brutal, was very, very brutal.
What a surprise. You
know. I think you already said German.
I, for one, am shocked.
Bukowski calls his childhood hell, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, there's a lot of frankness in the writing and without the writing, and I think that was the point that you were touching on earlier, Bruce. Is that it's just kind of he's not doing anything other than being himself in the writing,
describing
really.
His world,
right,
and in the simplest way possible, I think, and that's he loved Hemingway, and that's what Hemingway did, and mm-hmm. Hemingway's sentences were, you know, if he had a 10-word sentence, he'd probably, you know, regret it.
Yeah,
but yeah, did we
really discuss the title? Story very much. I was trying to make a little bit. Maybe I was reading some things into it, but I was trying to make a little more sense out of it than the usual. I was just wondering if the woman in this story was really him, and because. We were kind of discussing this on a walk over here. You know, she's wondering why people only appreciate her for her looks, her body, and he probably was starting to wonder you know, because he started getting a lot of women as he became more and more well known.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if he was just kind of wondering what the flip side of that is, because obviously the women weren't into him for his you know, his face, his looks, but they all wanted to get that, you know, that thing that they were into, his intellect or maybe just his notoriety.
And money. He started to have a lot of money later.
Yeah. Or just the cachet, the cool of being with this counterculture hero.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was, I think on some level, he was thinking, man, I wish somebody would just like me for what I look like, you know?
Yeah, the secret vanity of that everybody has,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, you know, you find me attractive, don't you? Because, you know, I can smile in the mirror and, yeah, I look pretty good.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why don't you like? Yeah. Everyone has that kind of secret vanity, and
And do you, or are you just fucking me because you want to say you fucked Bukowski?
Yeah. Right. And
to your friends.
You know, you like me for my mind. Screw that. How about what you see? Isn't that pleasing? You know, we all kind of work at it a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. And there were a couple of things in it that puzzled me. The one was this idea that. He mentions that she always showed up at the same time of day when he was in the tub, and she threw an elephant leaf.
Oh yeah,
on his private area, his groin, his penis, whatever you want to call
his
it.
Behind.
His no, behind,
his front behind.
Trying to keep it clean here. So I don't know what an elephant leaf is. Obviously,
yeah, me neither.
Leaf of some kind, but
probably a big leaf.
Yeah, it's a large leaf. It's like it's a
kind of like a banana leaf. Maybe.
Yeah, it's like a large leaf shaped leaf, like very stereotypically leaf shaped.
Is it well, not like a maple leaf? Is it a specific style. Tree that it's this
it's
from?
A bush. It's like a bush shrub thing. We had them at my house. So I'm actually surprised that nobody here
never
knew
heard of it.
Okay,
it's not like shaped like an elephant's ear.
No, kind of. It's almost heart shaped, kind of, but in a large, kind of poofy way. It's really hard to describe, but it's just a very large leaf.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, to me, that recalled sort of, you know, Garden of Eden. Adam
yeah,
and Eve,
I was thinking that too. Yeah.
And maybe, you know, in a way, they became the only two people in the world for each other for a short while.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he was. Trying, I don't know. I was wondering what you guys thought of that. If there was anything reminiscent, or if you think he was going for something grander.
Well, yeah, because that story also had the ending with the where he took a bottle of wine home and drank, and then there was and then the car started honking repeatedly. And
oh, he started yelling at the people at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was a car that just kept persistently honking, and he yelled at it, and then that was the end of the. That was just the end of that story.
Oh, I wish we could quote that. I think it was something like "Shut up, you goddamn fucking idiots," wasn't it?
Yeah. It was
something like that.
To it, yeah. Yeah. I think that story was the.
Somebody honked their automobile horn. They were very loud and persistent. I set the bottle down and screamed out, "God damn you, you son of a bitch! Shut up!"
Yeah.
The night kept coming on in, and there was nothing I could do.
That was like the
Great.
That was the one story that I did, because earlier we were talking about how there isn't really a lot of deeper meaning, or there may not even be. It may just be that it's what it is. That's the only story that we read that I really was wondering, like, if there really was a lot of deeper meaning, especially with what Mark was talking about. That is a lot of there's a lot of things that could come out there, but may not even be author intent.
They could be symbols, or they couldn't.
Right?
Yeah,
and there
I
may
agree.
Not be authorial intent at all.
Well, I think with a lot of his stories, it could or couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, I think you could get deep on this. They kind of stand pretty nicely on their own.
Right.
To a certain extent, you know, you could get kind of tired of the simplicity and start looking deeper and find this interesting reversal. Because we were saying, you know, like, who are the women that go for this guy? Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of like the women who, you know, are Charles Manson, you know, write him love letters in prison, the people that are attracted to a mass murderer or something like that. Because, I mean, you know, look at him. He's ugly and he's a drunk. And, you know, who goes for guys like that? You know, normally it's the handsome, you know, prom king or, you know, whatever. So maybe this was the reversal, and that he was the girl. And
it just felt like it. The more I read it, the more it seemed
he's crying.
Like
he's crying to be liked.
I want to throw one other thing out to you guys and see if you can give me any kind of an explanation for this. One image that was in there that I found interesting. He said, when they were making love, that long black hair lay behind me like a flag of death.
Mm.
And I remember that. More I thought about it, I thought, why was her hair behind him? And if it was, how did he see it? But the flag of death just seemed like, I don't know if that's just some foreshadowing he threw in there, or...
I think there was a lot of foreshadowing in that.
Yeah.
There was a something early on. What did he say? I'm looking. Somebody say something. But
well, one thing is the hat pin, you know, that she puts through her nose is a bit of foreshadowing.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Especially, you know, after he used the same thing to kill the woman in 6 inches.
It's the same hat pin. As we find out, it's all just the same thing.
It's like a Mr. Show thing.
Yeah,
each thing bleeds into the next, and
well, she she slits her neck, and when she's alive,
and
then later,
doesn't that save her from being?
She cuts her neck because a guy was interested in her, and then he runs out.
Well, I love the fact that she was in a convent for most of her life, and this is the first place she went after the convent is to a bar sitting next to him.
Yeah.
She goes straight from being released from the convent. I don't know the procedures there. I'm sorry, your time is up, sister initiate or whatever, and then she goes to a bar immediately.
Yeah.
Sits next to him, and, he goes, what's your name? And she says, does it really matter?
Yeah.
And she never ever tells him, actually.
No, but he knows it somehow. Yeah, right. I guess it's maybe the bartender knows it.
There was a bit of me, just because I'm used to reading weirder things like that, that I thought at the end of that story that she was a ghost, but then I realized no, she had, because he said she'd slit her neck, and I thought that the first time when he saw her, that one time when she had slit her neck but she was still alive, that was when she had actually died, and that he had just imagined seeing her for the rest of that time period.
Oh, that never even occurred to me as a possibility.
But
no, me either.
Yeah, but I mean, that just might be me.
And why did he leave? Why did he go away?
He went away the first time because he asked her to move in, and she said no, and I think he just got angry. I think that's part of that control thing I was talking about, where he was just
He slips in. There's very often he'll go through a whole paragraph that should have about five paragraph indentations in it, but he'll keep it in one paragraph. In the middle of it, he'll say, we fought a lot. And you're going, I can't even see that. But he goes, when he comes back and finds out she died, he had been away, and I'm thinking, why go?
Yeah.
She seems great. I would hang in there with this one.
Let her live at the convent. Go back and live at the convent. I'll visit you there. Maybe we'll get a couple of the other nuns involved.
Yeah.
That's a whole new take on Sister Act.
Oh, man.
All right. So let's do final thoughts. Mark, do you have any final thoughts about Bukowski in general, or just...
I find him to be a real interesting guy. I'm going to have to learn more about him. I think that the control thing is a very interesting angle, and I'm going to go back and reread these with that in mind, and some of these other stories too, because it seems like a person who's... one of the things he says throughout the whole thing is, I just always lived on luck.
Yeah.
In a lot of the stories, he says, I just always considered myself a guy that hoping more luck would come along. And that seems like the opposite of a person who is interested in controlling things. But sometimes those dichotomies mean a lot.
Nice. Bruce?
Bruce,
final thoughts?
I keep thinking about how I started reading him at such a young, comparatively young age, like in my early 20s, and I'm now 65, and how valuable it is. We were talking about cleansing palates, how valuable it is to go back and reread something that you were first taken with when you were very young or relatively young, and... it still holds up in many, many ways. In some ways, I don't know. But in many ways, there are certain things about his writing that you need to kind of remind yourself of. And I find them, it's valuable as a palate cleanser to go in there and read a little Bukowski every once in a while just to kind of keep yourself honest.
Yeah. You had a much more positive experience to Mark's Hardy Boys experience.
Yeah, well, I was kind of an idiot.
Well,
you know, I had no, all I wanted to do was play baseball when I was a kid.
Eh?
I just wanted to go outside and throw a ball against a chimney, against a wall, into the forest. I wanted to bat balls any which way, throw
but
myself.
But your parents made you practice the violin 12
yeah,
hours
and,
a day.
Yeah, and this was that case. Why don't you go read a book?
Yeah, friends.
I don't want to, because that means I have to sit down. And then when I first tried it, I went, I was prejudiced against it.
Yeah. Just the entire art form.
Right.
Yeah. You hate all brothers.
Hardy Boys.
any crime solving brothers.
All crime solving
brothers.
Very right. prejudiced against them still.
Yeah.
And well, just as a autobiographical note, the guy, my friend Chris, who was the well-read one, is still my best friend. We went to kindergarten together. I grew up with him, and he lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and there's three of us, Chris, my friend Crispin Cio, who's a musician out in New York. We have a connection that is kind of spooky when you have friends that are that old. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a 60-year-old
meaning
60 year
have
old
been
friend.
Your friends that long.
We don't ever skip a beat when we get back together again. We're the same goofballs that we were when we were 5 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's
it's,
nice.
It's real nice, even as different as we all turned out to be.
Nice. Runja, do you have any final thoughts about Bukowski? Or?
I just loved reconnecting with this book, because I've read this book many times but hadn't read it in like 20 years. And I love him just as much as I love his writing, just as much as I always did.
Yeah.
I think he's one of those writers, I think everyone ought to read a little bit of Bukowski. I think everyone should be familiar with him, you know?
Yeah, I hadn't really read any of his. I was vaguely familiar with his work, and I'd read a little bit here and there, but it was good. I want to read the rest of the book.
I think eight-year-old girls should probably not.
Well, yeah, okay.
If you're going to say everybody.
Especially
they
don't
with
read
Ramona
The Fiend.
Quimby.
If you guys read The Fiend, don't read that.
Be old enough. Yeah.
Oh, that, yes, I did read this.
What did everybody think of the movie Barfly?
I don't think
I have seen it, but it's been many years, and I forget.
I was.
That's a kind of a fictional biopic starring Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, I think I saw it when it came out.
It's in dangerous waters when you're reading someone depicting an author of yours. It's like meeting an author of yours. I met this guy, Alan First, who was an author that I tried to recall earlier, who writes about pre-World War II Germany and Poland and Eastern Europe. And I met him at this book signing. I couldn't wait to meet him because I loved his books. He's a jerk.
Yeah.
Jesus.
I had the same thing with Christopher Buckley. I really liked Christopher Buckley, and I met him, and he was a complete dick. Like, just complete dick to me.
Yeah.
Just totally. But then I met David Sedaris, nicest person I've ever met.
I would imagine.
David Sedaris, like, even people-wise, not even just authors, like, one of the nicest people I've ever met in my entire... And I've gone to his readings several times and gone there. He's super sweet. Yeah. Super nice guy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bruce, do you have anything coming up, or anything you want to point the listeners to in terms of your work?
You know, my wife and I are going to probably reestablish our two-person play at some point,
nice.
Based on a Second City scene. And
I saw it. It's great.
It's a nice little venting exercise for us, and
nice.
We also want to get a podcast together.
What's the title of the play?
The play is called Been There, Still There.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's based on a scene that we performed at Second City, based on a four-minute scene about a car voyage up into Wisconsin.
Nice.
That is awesome.
Yeah,
and,
that sounds great.
We expanded it to about 45 minutes. We've got one more scene to write, and then we'll do it again.
Nice.
The
scene that he's talking about that it's based on was just a classic scene with Mary Gross and Bruce's wife and Bruce.
Yeah.
And it was called Escape from Wisconsin, I think.
Wisconsin,
right?
Death Trip. Is
Wisconsin Death Trip.
Nice.
Based on, yeah. Del signed it that because Del found a book of... apparently there was a town in Wisconsin that... was besieged with rather erratic psychotic behavior back in the turn of the century. Something mm-hmm. happened to this town, Blackwater Falls, Wisconsin, I think it's called, in which people just started killing each other, hanging themselves, mm-hmm. Burning yeah. houses, killing horses, yeah. and just acting rather strangely. And it was photo documented. Part of the plot of the scene was that they turned the radio on and the radio announcer is out of his mind.
Wow.
So.
Well, all right.
But it's very funny and light.
Oh, sounds great. So, yeah, so keep an eye out for
frogs appearing in toilets, I
yes,
believe.
That's
doesn't
one
he?
Of them. Yeah. Yeah.
As a reminder, it says Been There, Still There.
Yeah. Right. Been There, Still There.
And we'll keep an eye out for it. All right. Great. Mark?
I have nothing theatrical coming up, but every third Tuesday of the month, I'm over at Lizard's Liquid Lounge singing jazz standards with
nice.
Some other people.
Great. All right. Cool.
That is awesome. Yeah. I really had no idea.
That's fantastic. All right. Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks. Thank you guys again for coming on the show.
Thank
we had a great time. Thank you. So, Roger, do you have anything coming up?
Well, yeah, I run two weekly shows, Saturdays, 6 p.m. in Chicago, and Sundays, 11 a.m., believe it or not, in Chicago. Run a show at both those times. So, find me on Facebook or Twitter if you want more info. Yeah. But that's every week. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. And then I have a new panel show starting up with Brian Bowden and Stephen Lyons. Brian Bowden's a former guest of the show. It's called Just the Facts, FAQS. That'll be a monthly show at Stage 773 starting in November. And you can find more information at on my Twitter and Facebook at eccentricgent, facebook.com/eccentricgent. Cool. All right. That's been it. Thank you again for listening. You can find this podcast and everything related to it, facebook.com/tomefoolery, on Twitter at tomefoolery. You can go to tomefoolery.com, download it there or on iTunes. If you've downloaded it on iTunes, please rate it and give us a comment. Send us any emails at tomefoolery@gmail.com. Thank you again to John and Rob Scallon for our theme song and Rob Scallon for the use of our close song. I've, of course, been Cody Melcher.
I've been Ranjit Sowry, and we'd like to thank our guests today, Bruce Jarko and Mark Belden. Thank you both for joining us. It was great fun.
Thanks for having us.
That sounded weird.
No, that was great. It was great. It was great fun.
It was.
All right. And remember, listeners, pros before hoes.
Pros before hoes.
Thanks, guys.
There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I'm too tough for him. I say, stay in there. I'm not going to let anybody see you. There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I pour whiskey on him and inhale cigarette smoke. And the somethings and the bartenders and the grocery clerks never know that he's in there. There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I'm too tough for him. I say, stay down. Do you want to mess me up? You want to screw up the works? You want to blow my book sales in Europe? There's a bluebird in my heart that wants to get out, but I'm too clever. I only let him out at night sometimes when everybody's asleep. I say, I know that you're there, so don't be sad. Then I put him back, but he's singing a little in there. I haven't quite let him die, and we sleep together like that with our secret pact, and it's nice enough to make a man weep. But I don't weep, do you?
There are worse things than being alone, but it often takes decades to realize this. And most often when you do, it's too late. And there's nothing worse than too late.
It's not the large things that send a man to the madhouse, death he's ready for, or murder, incest, robbery, fire, flood. No, it's the continuing series of small tragedies that send a man to the madhouse. Not the death of his love, but a shoelace that snaps, with no time left. And with each broken shoelace, out of 100 broken shoelaces, one man, one woman, one thing enters a madhouse. So, be careful when you bend over.